history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. They're not looking for attention. They're not asking for anything, but they are certainly deserving of our gratitude. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we are educated, we're entertained, and we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. In the weeks ahead, we're going to hear from a California pilot who had to fly the hump over the Himalayas to China. We're going to hear from a concrete finisher in a tiny town in New Mexico who was a cook in World War II, but ended up flying bombing missions as a replacement gunner. Today, though, we're going to focus on honor flight, something you've heard me talk about a time or two, but a cause that is so connected to the aim of this program. It's an effort that's ongoing wherever you're listening today. In fact, if you're hearing us on our newest Hometown Heroes affiliate, WRFH in Hillsdale, Michigan, Talons Out Honor Flight has a group of World War II vets in Washington, D.C. this very weekend. So does Honor Flight Kern County in California. In fact, if you're listening on our affiliate there, KNZR, you can welcome veterans home Monday night at 8:30 at the Bakersfield Airport. That's Monday, April 25th, 8:30 p.m. If you're hearing us in Albuquerque, Northern New Mexico Honor Flight is taking off again on June 1st. Just a few examples of what I mean when I say this is happening wherever you're hearing the show today. And instead of listening to just one veteran story today, we're going to hear from three different men who will finally get to see their memorial next week. You see, the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. wasn't completed until 2004, but it is a special, special place. And the idea behind Honor Flight is to make sure every World War II vet has the opportunity to see it. Nobody can speak to that mission better than Earl Morse, the founder of the Honor Flight Network, who joined us on this program years ago when he was just building momentum, to explain how it all started.
We got our start in May of 2005 here in the Springfield, Ohio area. At the time, I was a physician assistant, having the honor and privilege of caring for America's veterans here in Springfield, Ohio. And sadly, here we were about 3, then 6, then 9 months after the World War II Memorial was dedicated. I was seeing approximately 300 World War II veterans in that clinic there, and not one of them had been out to see their memorial. And the worst part was that reality had set in. When I would ask the veterans, I said, you haven't been to see your memorial? Well, why not? And they'd always say, well, you know, the kids, they've been real busy, and Ma, she's been kind of sick, and we don't have the money. Well, I'm very fortunate in that I'm also a private pilot and a retired Air Force captain, a member of one of the largest aero clubs in the nation out here at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So we started renting planes, paying for them out of pocket to have the honor and privilege of taking these incredible men and women, flying them out personally to Washington, D.C. to visit their memorials. We took to the skies in May of 2005. We took off in 6 planes. We flew 12 veterans. And then the next month, 8 planes, 16 veterans. The third month, 10 planes. We flew 20 veterans, and I was so proud of our effort. I went to my mom, who's been with me from the get-go, helping out. I said, Mom, we're flying 20 World War II veterans every month. Can you believe that? And she said, but son, we're getting 95 applications a month. So confronted with that major math problem there, we started looking at the commercial carriers like Southwest and AirTran and seeing how much it was going to cost us to buy up seats on those commercial carriers. And we started doing that. There is a wonderful gentleman down in Hendersonville, North Carolina. His name is Jeff Miller. And he saw what we were doing, and he said he'd like to start something like that out of Hendersonville. And I told him how to go about doing that. You know, you need a commercial carrier with direct nonstop service. And he said, we don't have that available, so we're thinking about chartering an aircraft. What really warms my heart, Paul, is that we thought out here in Ohio that we were the people that had the biggest heart for these World War II veterans. But I'll tell you what, I am finding out that all across this great nation of ours, there are are citizens everywhere that do not take for granted the liberties and the blessings and the freedoms that we all enjoy, and they want to see those veterans that secured those liberties that we all enjoy finally get to see their memorial.
Again, that was Earl Morse, founder of the Honor Flight Network, which has continued to grow and grow. Thousands and thousands of World War II veterans have been able to see their memorial free of charge. And in many places, Korean War veterans and even Vietnam vets have been able to experience Honor Flight as well. Where I live in Central California, we started Central Valley Honor Flight in 2013. And to parallel what you heard Earl Morse say, we have seen the heart that people have for these heroes. The response has been incredible. The 9th Central Valley Honor Flight is headed out Monday morning and will return Wednesday night, April 27th. I'll be out at the Fresno Yosemite International Airport to welcome them home. So if you're in my area, I'd love to see you there Wednesday at 5:30. And if you do come, you can keep an eye out for the men we're going to hear from now, three of the vets who will be taking this journey of a lifetime. Let's start with Wayne Thompson of Clovis, California, who had a unique role for 30 missions in B-17s over Europe during World War II. He's 92 years old now, but the Pennsylvania native was just 18 and off studying engineering at Ohio State when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
I guess you'd have to have been there to feel it, but there was a tension and an atmosphere of what can we do for our country? And even though we didn't want to be taken out of college, I felt that it was a pretty big thing to be able to jump into the Air Force and be a potential pilot in the Air Force.
And that's the one, and people who listen to this show regularly are probably sick of hearing me say this, but every time I interview someone who was in the Air Corps, I ask that question because it seems like no matter if you ended up as a bombardier or a gunner or a navigator, you chose the Air Corps because you wanted to be a pilot, right?
Yes, yes. And you may want to talk about it later, Paul, but later on in my cadet training, it was discovered I was colorblind. So they immediately ran me out of being a pilot, and I got back in on a waiver to be a bombardier. So that's how I happened to be a bombardier. I was really disappointed that I wasn't going to. By that time, I had 10 hours of flying in a Piper Cub.
And once you get that taste of it, you don't want to let it go, right?
Yeah, I was hot to trot. I scooted around and found out that it was possible to get a waiver. And I did that, and I got accepted. And so immediately I was put back into what was called the cadet training program. The only difference was I was trained as a bombardier, not as a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we flew in AT-11s, which was a twin-engine plane for bombing and navigation, but it was not a hot pursuit.
No, and a B-17 wasn't either. This was going to be a big beast you'd end up on. But as some of our listeners know, when you're on a bombing run in a B-17, there's one person that's in control of that aircraft.
That's right.
And that was?
That was me. Uh-huh. In fact, as standard bombardier, every plane had a bombardier in the nose. But because I was a radar bombardier navigator, I flew lead, and I was actually directing 12 planes, or in some cases, 24 planes or 36 planes over a target.
Your very first mission with the 379th Bomb Group out of Kimbolton, England, targeted Mannheim, Germany on December 11th, 1944. What did that first mission teach you about what this was all going to be like?
That anti-aircraft fire really is anti-aircraft fire. And an old timer told me over there, he said, as long as you can see the black clouds, you're okay. But when you start hearing it, then you know it's getting close.
And when you feel it, it's the worst, huh?
Right.
So did you feel any flak that day?
No. I really can't tell you, Paul, what made my luck different, but I really never had close hits from flak. We had a lot of bad weather, and a couple of times I thought we were going to have collisions because of bad weather, but it's just one of those things.
Well, and you bore a heavy responsibility for that as the navigator bombardier on the yeah. lead aircraft.
Yes.
And I don't want to miss one important thing here, too. And we had a bombardier on this program a while back who had a silver dollar that his wife gave him that he carried with him on every bombing mission. Your wife gave you something else that you wore every time you went up in the sky.
Yeah, she gave me a special wrist bracelet with my name on it, and I wore it every mission. every mission.
And I'm sure there are plenty of times you looked over at it and thought of her, right?
Yes.
So now explain to our listeners, if you can, the significance of being the lead aircraft and why it was you, why you had to be the bombardier on that lead aircraft on all of these missions.
Okay. You might call it, Paul, a triple layer of backup. We had a regular bombardier, we had a regular navigator, but so much of Germany was overcast in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the bombardier and the navigator couldn't see, they were useless in terms of being effective.
Right.
And that's where the radar took over. So I, you know, many days I actually took squadrons or two squadrons or three squadrons, sometimes a group lead. I took them in because I could see by radar where we were going.
So you're sitting in the nose of the airplane?
No, we're sitting just back of the bomb bay. The radio op was on my left, and I was on the right. The radar unit was just behind me in the fuselage area.
And I don't want to overstate it, but I'm just trying to get a picture of how big of a deal this is, and I'm sure our listeners are trying to figure it out too. A lot of these missions, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've got squadron after squadron heading for the same bombing target, and they're all dependent on you in that lead plane to direct them to the target.
Yes.
Was that pressure on you?
Well, maybe part of it was being the wonders of youth. You know, we were all scared. You got to admit that. And particularly if there's bad flak coming up and aircraft fire. But it was just a job, I think, Paul. You know, and I had the courage and the skill and the drive to make damn sure, you know, it was okay. You know, everything was going to be okay.
And you were 21 years old.
21.
That's a lot of responsibility for a 21-year-old.
Yeah, we were glad to be back at the end of the flight. You know, sometimes it was 10 hours, 11 hours, and you were on oxygen from 12,000 feet up, and we usually went in at 25,000 or 27,000. So there was no pressurized cabin. It was cold. It was miserable.
Yeah, this is December of 44, the coldest winter that Europe had ever seen.
Yes.
And you're higher up with no pressurized cabin. Brr, again. I'm going to read for you the text of a citation for the Distinguished Flying Cross, which Wayne received, not even knowing that he received it, and we'll get that story. But here it goes. It says, Wayne B. Thompson, 1st Lieutenant Air Corps, United States Army, for extraordinary achievement while serving as radar navigator of bombardment formations composed of B-17 aircraft on bombing missions over Germany, 2 March 1945 and 30 March 1945. Unable to bomb the primary target on 2 March 1945, Lieutenant Thompson directed the formation to a secondary objective where an instrument bomb run was initiated. Although excessive headwinds were encountered, this officer furnished computations which enabled bombs to be released with accuracy. On 30 March 1945, the outstanding proficiency exhibited by Lieutenant Thompson was instrumental in the successful bombing of a vital enemy installation in the face of adverse weather conditions. The courage, coolness, and skill displayed by Lieutenant Thompson reflect the highest credit upon himself and the armed forces of the United States. And you didn't know about this until you were already back home?
I was back home. In fact, I was going to Purdue University, and I got announcement in the mail. And they want to know if I'd come to Washington. I said, I can't. Yeah, I'm going to school.
They wanted you to go to Washington to have a general pin it on you?
Yeah. So I said, I can't do that. So they said, all right, we'll mail it to you.
Uh-huh. Funny how things work. Now let's get back to these missions. So on March 2nd of 1945, and according to your log, the target that time was Chemnitz. And this says that you couldn't bomb the primary target, and that was because of the weather?
Yeah, and in fact, Paul, in those days, at least in my experience in those days, nobody talked about jet stream. But we actually had picked up a jet stream going in to the target. And I called the chief pilot, and I said, sir, if we continue on this plan, we're going to have a ground speed of about 80 miles an hour because of the headwind. So he said, well, we can't do it. And I said, that's right. So he said, what do you want to do? I said, well, let's go to the secondary, which was a different heading.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did, and we made a good run.
But you still, no one could see the targets. It says
That's
here
right.
an instrument bomb run.
Yeah, I use radar.
So when you're looking through that in that radar equipment, what are you seeing that tells you you found your target, it's time to drop the bombs? Because that's a pretty significant thing to drop these bombs. If you're not hitting your target, you're killing civilians.
Right. The radar had various settings. One, you could see the whole western coast of Europe. Then as you kept reducing your ranges down, you get down to like a 10-mile range.
Mm-hmm.
So then you're able to focus in on the target. And radar on targets, it was perfect if there was a river next to it where you could absolutely zero in on your target. Otherwise, you had to keep shooting fixes on other towns or radar maps to make sure you're on the right one.
The river would help you because there's no...
There's no return. It was just... You would see the perfect outline of the river. In fact, over Bremen, the submarine pens, you could actually almost see the pens with radar.
And obviously that's another place that you bombed. But so this, what it credits in this citation was the computations which enabled bombs to be released with accuracy. So you don't have a little computer like they have these days. You don't have a calculator in your hand. You're scribbling out on a piece of paper, doing the math to figure out that you're going to the right spot?
Yeah. Actually, part of the plan of radar bombing was you would also set up the lead bombardier in the nose. I would call out fixes to him, and the Norden bomb site, he would then set it up so that if he could at the last second see it, he could take over.
Mm-hmm.
But usually he never saw it. But what I was actually doing was calling out successive ranges as we were going over the target areas.
Mm-hmm.
So in that process, we set up the bomb site so it would all be an automatic drop.
Gotcha. So that was March 2nd of 1945. And then on the 30th of March that month, the other mission that this Distinguished Flying Cross citation mentions, Bremen was your target. The U-boat pens that so many people have heard of were right along the river there, as you talked about. And in this time, it says they're giving you credit because of the adverse weather conditions that you faced. Yeah. How crazy was it?
It was pretty crazy. In fact, like the 12 planes in a squadron, it was difficult for the 12 planes to stay together. The weather was that bad. In fact, I think, as I recall in that mission, some squadrons or other groups, some of them aborted, went back because they just couldn't hack it. They couldn't stay with it.
Now, what made your mind, and obviously you're the radar navigator of the lead plane, but this is a discussion you're probably having with your pilot as well, I imagine.
Yes.
What made that decision to keep going and make sure you hit this target?
Well, it's probably a combination. You had to have a lead pilot and his crew that were willing to take the chance of bad weather, because there's always a chance in bad weather of mid-air collisions. So, you know, maybe part of it was luck, Paul. I don't know, but he elected to go through it, and I just kept calling out the checkpoints and guiding them in.
There's a little more to Wayne's story that I want you to hear. If you're a parent, I think this is really going to resonate with you. We'll get to that after the break, and also meet two other World War II vets who will get to see their memorial in the week ahead thanks to Honor Flight. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.